Father-son relationships are like none other. Many are really special, as described by a second grader who said, "My dad is the best dad ever. He taught me how to make a wooden airplane. It was the best plane ever. We are true pals. I would kiss a pig for him." Or the eighth grader who said, "One of the funnest times I have had with him was on a camping trip with the Boy Scouts. We fished, hiked, and carved wood. At night, he snored so loud we thought it was a bear. It was a great experience." Parent-child relationships are important. Of course, you know that. Everybody knows that. But we sometimes forget that when we are talking about people who are famous or powerful or prominent. Sometimes we see politicians and other leaders in terms of their public position or their public policy and forget that they eat and sleep and dream and laugh and cry just like the rest of us, and that they have family relationships, and that it is perhaps more difficult when scrutinized by millions or hundreds of millions of analysts. So whether a movie star in a mansion or a queen in a palace or a president on the second floor of the White House, all face family issues just like the rest of us. And that's the way it was for King David. His heart was broken. One of his sons raped one of his daughters. Another son killed his brother. And David had more family trauma than probably any of us would ever experience. The Old Testament law called for capital punishment of a murderer, although it seems to be a sentence that was only rarely ever carried out. Prince Absalom had murdered Prince Amnon because of his rape of Princess Tamar. And Princess Tamar, after that, became a recluse, never coming out of her place in a sub-palace in Jerusalem. Absalom, fearing that he would be arrested and tried and executed, fled the country, went to a neighbor nation in self-imposed exile. That meant that King David, in a short period of time, had lost all relationship with three of his children, one to death, one to exile, and one who had become a recluse who never came out any longer to the family or to the royal court. David had lost three of his children in three different directions in just 2 years. No parent who ever loses a child ever heals from that loss. It may get somewhat easier or better, but it never completely heals. David's loss of his son Amnon in time was tempered. His yearning for his son Absalom in exile in a neighbor nation haunted him every day. But he also knew that if he brought Absalom back to Jerusalem, that he would be arrested and tried and possibly executed. So David was caught between two awful alternatives, and his heart ached every day over this. One of his advisors was the general of the army named Joab, and he could see what was going on in David's heart. And so he wanted to fix it. He decided that the king needed some reconciliation. It wasn't good for the royal family, but it wasn't good for the nation either, that this dysfunction was going to leak over into the entire country. Besides that, there was a significant political question of who would become the successor to the king. That was not clear. And if David were to die, there would be a risk of yet another civil war. So 2 Samuel 14:1 says that Joab, son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart longed for Absalom. And he decided to do something about it, something that would be good for the royal family and good for the country. He started out by recruiting a storyteller. So Joab sent someone to Tekoa and had a wise woman brought from there. He said to her, "Pretend you are in mourning. Dress in mourning clothes and don't use any cosmetic lotions. Act like a woman who has spent many days grieving for the dead. Then go to the king and speak these words to him. And Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman from Tekoa went to the king, she fell with her face to the ground to pay him honor. And she said, "Help me, O king." The king asked her, "What is troubling you?" She said, "I am indeed a widow. My husband is dead." So Joab went on a search for a storyteller, and he chose someone not from Jerusalem, someone that David wouldn't recognize. Instead, he went 10 miles away to the town of Tekoa in the hills of Judah. She is called a wise woman because it seems that there were a lot of wise people who lived in Tekoa, and it became a name that was given to a lot of them. And besides, she was a good talker. He recruited her because, actually, she was something of a professional actress, and he was managing every detail of what he had planned. He picked someone who looked the part. He chose the clothing that she was to wear. He ordered the makeup, actually the lack of makeup, and he wrote every line that she was to memorize and that she was to speak, even down to the details of the gestures that she would use. And then, from his powerful position in the royal court, he set up an appointment with His Majesty King David. And she was set to give the performance of her lifetime. Ayir's servant had two sons. They got into a fight with each other in the field, and no one was there to separate them. One struck the other and killed him. Now the whole clan has risen up against your servant. They say, "Hand over the one who struck his brother down so that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. And then we will get rid of the heir as well." They would put out the only burning coal I have, leaving my husband neither name nor descendant on the face of the earth. And so she presented a sad dilemma. The local authorities wanted her to turn over her last living child. And if she turned him over for killing her other son, then they were going to execute him. So she's already a widow. She has lost one son, and she would lose the other. And the way the laws were working, she would also lose the inheritance, that is, the family farm and the place to live. So she would end up destitute, no place to live and no family, if she did what the law said, and that is, turn her son over to the authorities. So what would you do? Would you turn your son over if they were going to execute him? The king said to the woman, "Go home and I will issue an order in your behalf." But the woman from Tekoa said to him, "My lord the king, let the blame rest on me and on my father's family, and let the king and his throne be without guilt." The king replied, "If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he will not bother you again." She said, "Then let the king invoke the Lord his God to prevent the avenger of blood from adding to the destruction so that my son will not be destroyed." "As surely as the Lord lives," King David said, "not one hair of your son's head will fall to the ground." David was, in those days, the Supreme Court and the supreme judge of Israel. He knew the law better than anybody in the country knew the law. And yet he was going to make an exception. He was going to issue an executive order. He was going to grant a pardon and protect her son from any arrest or further prosecution. And why would he do that? Well, because he thought that was the just and right thing to do. To, at least in this case, set aside the law so that her son could live. Then the woman said, "Let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." "Speak," he replied. The woman said, "Why then have you devised a thing like this against the people of God? When the king says this, does he not convict himself? For the king has not brought back his banished son. Like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be recovered, so we must die. But God does not take away life. Instead, he devises ways so that a banished person may not remain estranged from him." And now I've come to say this to my lord the king because the people have made me afraid. Your servant thought, I will speak to the king. Perhaps he will do what his servant asks. Perhaps the king will agree to deliver his servant from the hand of the man who is trying to cut off both me and my son from the inheritance God gave us. And now your servant says, may the word of my lord the king bring me rest, for my lord the king is like an angel of God in discerning good and evil. May the Lord your God be with you. And it turns out that this wise woman of Tekoa is wise indeed, perhaps echoing words that she was taught and memorized from Joab, but perhaps not. Perhaps here speaking extemporaneously, increasingly from her heart. And she weaves together philosophy and theology and politics and family relationships. And she is definitely pro-life. She says, God does not take life away. But most of all, she dares to confront the king about his own family relationship. She's saying, you're telling me that my son, who is a murderer, should be pardoned so that we can be together. But why don't you apply that same principle to your own son? Why don't you pardon him and you be reconciled with Absalom? When water is spilled on the ground, when things happen, you can't get it back. You can't turn the page in reverse. So move on. Bring Absalom home. And it was, I think, good advice. Although, if you are a legal analyst, you will be quick to say that the two stories really are not legally comparable. Her two sons were out in a field and they got in a fight and it just got out of hand. And one killed the other. And at most, the one who had killed the other would be charged with manslaughter, which was not a capital offense. By contrast, Absalom had planned premeditated murder for 2 years. He had worked out every detail, and it was without a doubt capital murder. It was a very different offense. But the advice to reconcile estrangement in the family, that was really good advice. David, somebody's got to break the logjam. Somebody's got to do something. I know, as you know, families where people in the family don't speak to each other. Somebody offended somebody or somebody took offense, and it may have been years ago. And actually, it's to the point where nobody remembers what the original offense was. It's just now we're mad because they don't speak anymore. And nobody is willing to go first. Nobody's willing to do what needs to be done to reconcile the relationship. And she is saying, Your Majesty, you go first. You do what you need to do in order to heal the family fracture. And then the king said to the woman, Do not keep from me the answer of what I'm going to ask you. Let my lord the king speak, the woman said. The king asked, Isn't the hand of Joab with you in all this? Do you really think this up yourself? The woman answered, As surely as you live, my lord the king, she's really good at flattery. No one can turn to the right or to the left from anything my lord the king says. Yeah, it was your servant Joab who instructed me to do this and who put all these words into the mouth of your servant. Your servant Joab did this to change the present situation. My lord has wisdom like that of an angel. He knows everything that happens in the land. The king said to Joab, Very well, I will do it. Go, bring back the young man Absalom. Joab fell with his face to the ground to pay him honor, and he blessed the king. Joab said, Today your servant knows that he has found favor in your eyes, my lord the king, because the king has granted his servant's request. So David recognizes who's behind all of this, and it is General Joab. And the wise woman from Tekoa, she admits to the ploy to influence the king, and she throws in a few lines of flattery to sort of grease the whole situation and keep the king in a really good mood. And after all of this, David agrees. He says, Very well, I will do this. Go bring back the young man, Absalom. Joab, he's ecstatic. He's changed the king's mind. He has saved the royal family. He has saved the kingdom of Israel. Good for him. And he never dreams that what he has done is set up a trajectory for high treason against King David and the throne of Israel. Then Joab went to this nearby kingdom of Geshur and brought Absalom back to Jerusalem. But the king said, he must go to his own house. He must not see my face. So Absalom went to his own house and did not see the face of the king. David calls his estranged son Absalom back home to Jerusalem, and he didn't tie one single yellow ribbon around the old olive tree to welcome him home. So it's sort of welcome home, kind of. I just don't want to see your face. And Absalom goes back to his own house, and where before they were many miles apart, now they're down the block from each other and just as distant as they ever were before. Absalom, he was amazing. He had everything going for him except integrity. He was this really good-looking man. He had perfect features. He had magnificent long hair. He was a family man. He had children, good-looking children. He was winsome, and he was articulate, and he was an extrovert, and people loved him, and he had all the perfect mix for a political candidate who would attract a crowd around him. He had everything except integrity. So he was fabulous on the outside, but fatally flawed on the inside. Okay, so what did he look like? In all Israel, there was not a man so highly praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the top of his head to the sole of his foot, there was no blemish in him. Whenever he cut the hair of his head, he used to cut his hair once in a while from time to time. When it became too heavy for him, he would weigh it. Have you ever weighed your hair after a haircut? And its weight was 200 shekels by the royal standard. That's about 4.5 pounds of hair. So, I don't know, how long would it take you to grow 4.5 pounds of hair? 3 sons and a daughter were born to Absalom. The daughter's name was Tamar. And she became a beautiful woman. Absalom lived 2 years in Jerusalem without seeing the king's face. Then Absalom sent for Joab in order to send him to the king, but Joab refused to come to him. So he sent a second time, but he refused to come. Then he said to his servants, look, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire. So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab did go to Absalom's house, and he said to him, why have your servants set my field on fire? Absalom said to Joab, look, I sent word to you and said, come here so I can send you to the king to ask, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me if I were still there. Now then, I want to see the king's face. If I'm guilty of anything, he can put me to death. This is one really dysfunctional family and a whole dysfunctional court. So, like, I'm thinking if they ever lose their job running a country, they could get a reality show on cable TV. There'd be no difficulty at all. This would get lots of sponsors. So David, he summons Absalom, and then he won't see him. His father won't see his own son. So he's not there for birthday parties. Doesn't go to the grandchildren's t-ball games and misses out on the 4th of July barbecue. I mean, there's like zero. So what kind of a father is David anyway? And Absalom, he's so annoyed by this rejection that he keeps calling for Joab to come over and fix it, because Joab thinks he can fix pretty much anything. And when he doesn't come, because he has a primary loyalty to the king who doesn't want him to come, then Absalom says, all right, I'll do what I need to do to get his attention. And he sets his crops on fire. So Absalom, the murderer, is now an arsonist. And understand that this is the ancient Middle East. This is an agricultural society. This is a hot and dry climate where fire can be devastating. Take out one field's crop and you're at risk of that fire spreading to another field, potentially spreading to the city itself and taking out the whole city of Jerusalem. This has the potential of risking a famine and toppling the government of the nation. And he does this to get attention. So it's just kind of crazy. And what does Joab do? So Joab went to the king and told him this. Then the king summoned Absalom, and he came in and bowed down with his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So, like, is this a good idea or what? I mean, this doesn't seem like a good idea to me. He's a murderer and an arsonist, and the king, when he orders the fire, brings him in and kisses him. He doesn't arrest him. He doesn't punish him. He kisses him. But what if we were there? What if you were there? If you're giving advice on this, what do you think that David should have done? Go by the law? Order his son arrested and tried and executed for murder? And that's what he did. There aren't many fathers that would do that. So what would you do? Or what about Absalom? His brother raped his sister. Is he supposed to just let that happen? The authorities never arrested him. Nobody ever said anything to Amnon when he did this. Just let it go. Where is justice in that? And so Absalom took the law into his own hands. He became the police and the judge and the jury and the executioner because he just wasn't going to let anybody get away with doing what Amnon did to his sister, Princess Tamar. And what's he supposed to do when his father brings him back to town and then won't see him and then won't take any messages to try to fix things up? Is there any other choice that he had except to start a fire in order to get enough attention so that he could try to break this relational logjam? And what about Joab? And what would you do if you were Joab? He's caught in the middle. I don't know if you've ever been caught in the middle of somebody else's family dispute, but it's not a happy place to be because people can quickly turn on you. And no matter what you say, you're often in a lose-lose situation. Okay, so what should have been done here? And there's no easy answer to that question. And what should have been done is it never should have happened in the first place. You back it up and back it up and back it up. And you begin to realize that sin piled upon sin piled upon sin, and that it all got knotted together in this tangle of wild circumstances that fell totally out of control, because that's what sin does. Sin piles upon sin, and it ties knots that are so tight that there is no simple or easy solution to get out of it. And next week, we come back to this story and we discover that this mess gets even messier. So our hearts are heavy for those long ago who got themselves into this entangled family riddled with sin and problems. And we're saddened. Saddened for the estrangement between father and son. For people trying to do what's right and fair and can't quite pull it off. So what do you do? What do you do if a father does not measure up to be and do all a father is supposed to be and a father's supposed to do? Robert Mulholland tells the story of a woman he met who was the result of an unwanted pregnancy. And this haunted her for her lifetime. She had a theological issue. How would God, why would God, ever allow her to even be born in the first place? She was the child of a prostitute. Her father was completely unknown. In God's grace, she became a believer, a follower of Jesus Christ. She married a fine Christian man. They had wonderful children. She lived in a lovely home with a stable family. But every day, she couldn't get past trying to figure out who her father was and why this had happened, until it started to spill over into her marriage, into all of the family relationships. She reported that one day she was washing dishes in her kitchen, and she was just filled with frustration and tears when she blurted out a prayer. I'm not even sure she thought of it as a prayer. She said out loud, "God, who is my father?" And she says that she then heard an audible voice that said, "I am your father." But she thought she was home alone and that someone had come into her house and into her kitchen, and so she spun around. But no one was there. And she says she heard the voice again, this time saying, "I am your father, and I have always been your father." One of the writers of one of the Old Testament Psalms, not David, gave us the words in Psalm 10:14. "But you, O God, do see trouble and grief. You consider it to take it in hand. The victim commits himself to you. You are the helper of the fatherless." God, we live in a tangled up, fallen, and sinful world, and sometimes the knots are all through our family relationships and other relationships until we just can't untie them. And so we turn to you, and we ask you to do that which is impossible for us to even begin. We come to you as our loving Heavenly Father and ask for your help in victory over the sins and the knots of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.